Hi everyone, welcome to History of Asia, where we try to understand, as best we can, how the Asian world came to be this way. And we do that by digging ever deeper into the past, one flashback at a time. Last episode, we talked about how Alexander the Great brought down the Persian Empire of the Achaemenids. So, historically dyslexic as we are now going to talk about the reign of these Achaemenids. This is quite an important subject. They ran by far the largest empire that ever existed up till that point, and one of the biggest in history also. And it shouldn't be too hard to make an entertaining episode about them, for they are undeniably an interesting bunch. Theirs is a story full of hubris, intrigue, inhuman cruelty, and incest. Or is it? Unfortunately, the historian of ancient Persia runs into the same sorts of problems as those studying Alexander the Great. Well, it's a bit different, but it's no better. Alexander fully recognized the usefulness of history being written in his own vision, and so too did the Hellenistic kings, who built their legitimacy on his. This messes up the sources, as we've seen in past episodes. The Persians, on the other hand, didn't write history at all, not as we would recognize it. They had songs and poems about the past, but how things happened exactly, that wasn't all that interesting to them. It was more about the message that it sent, about how gods and kings were responsible for the order in the world and the cosmos. Alas for them, their main rivals, the Greeks, had already left the prehistoric era behind by then. So unfortunately, if we want to learn about the Persians, we are dependent on the tales of their bitterest rivals. And as you can imagine, Herodotus, or Xenophon, were not exactly unbiased. They did have first-hand experience of the Persian Empire. After all, they spent a big part of their lives there, but they catered to an audience that was very anti-Persian. There are certainly some facts in their histories, but it's nigh on impossible to separate these from the so-called motifs. And that hardly changed for the better with the rise of Rome. For the Romans too, Persians were hated enemies. Just think of Crassus, butchered by the Parthian cavalry, or think of Emperor Valerian, who was taken captive by the Sassanians. From the Parthian and Sassanian perspectives on history, there is also little left for us to read. So if we want to learn about the Persian empires of antiquity, we have always been dependent on the narratives of their bitterest rivals. This has huge ramifications. The Greek classics are still part of Western school curriculums to this day, as are those of Roman writers. And this has been the case ever since the Renaissance, when European intellectuals fell totally in love with Greece and Rome. Enlightenment thinkers would go even further. They were looking for a new way to explain Western superiority, and they were no longer willing to do that in terms of Christianity. Instead, they stressed the so-called typical Western cultural values and traditions, which they traced back to Rome, and especially to ancient Greece. The Romans and Greeks, it was assumed, invented freedom and rationality. Therefore, other peoples, who are unfortunately bereft of these beneficial heritage, lacked the capability to reason and rule themselves. So bringing them civilization would become the Europeans' task, even before racism began to really make its mark. After all, freedom was meant for European peoples, slavery for those of Asia, as Montesquieu wrote in his Persian Letters. As the eternal enemy of Greece and Rome, Persia, like no other, was seen as the antithesis to European values. Today, these ancient stereotypes are not just present in schoolbooks anymore, they've effectively entered popular culture. Just think of the hugely popular film 300. Now, I get it, this sort of movie is of course meant to be over the top, and wouldn't claim to be historically accurate in any shape or form, I hope. But still, many Iranians were aghast to be portrayed as bloodthirsty aliens. It could perhaps have been funny had it not come on top of a mountain of already sticky stereotypes. The ancient Persians have forever been portrayed as the ultimate enemies of Western civilization. Vile, cruel, corrupt, and above all, fearing the whip of their tyrannical masters. Given the available sources, that was only to be expected. Luckily, that may finally be about to change. not because of what is happening in the world of politics and diplomacy, alas, and not even because of this podcast and the huge impact it will surely have on public opinion worldwide, but because of recent developments in the hidden worlds of archives, excavations, and scientific papers. Apparently, despite the tense situation, brave historians have managed to do a lot of valuable research in Iran itself lately. For the first time ever, they're making full use of the massive quantity of Persian sources that are available. Lloyd Llewellyn Jones, for instance, has recently published a brand new history of Persia, based largely on such new sources in local archives. Now, these are not histories per se, as I said, the Persians didn't write any, but rather they are more mundane leftovers, like bureaucratic records, human remains, or clothes. These don't provide a coherent narrative on their own, but they do allow to check, up to a point at least, whether the stereotypes of Herodotus and friends can stand up to scrutiny. For instance, were the Persian kings decadent weaklings, who were bossed about by eunuchs and courtesans? Were their people soft and scared? Did they lack honor or love of freedom? Were they sneaky? Were they corrupt? Were their armies so numerous that they drank rivers dry? Today's episode, which owes a large debt to Professor Jones's work, tries to look for an answer. Let's start with the most pervasive stereotype, perhaps. Ever since Herodotus, Persia has been portrayed as a slave state, to be contrasted with the freedom-loving Greeks, of course. To what extent is this true? Well, it seems that at first, the Persians didn't have a tradition of owning many slaves at all. Paid laborers did much of the building, or called up peasants occasionally. But the Persians were, of course, epic conquerors. Theirs was the largest empire the world had ever seen. And in the ancient world, conquest always resulted in human spoils. So a bit like with the Roman Empire, though to a lesser degree, as Persia expanded, there was a steady stream of people moving toward the imperial centers. And once there, they were set to work, and not voluntarily. Recently discovered sources have revealed the meager rations that these people received, barely enough to subsist. The families of deportees were routinely torn apart. Though marriages between slaves were never recognized, they were encouraged to mate with other slaves so as to produce children that could then in turn serve their greedy masters. Those with more children got more food and sometimes less hard work. Interestingly, men were worth twice as much as girls on the market, which says something about the purposes for which they would be used often. And that was not the norm in this part of the world, as I explained in an earlier episode already. So to conclude, I think it's hardly exaggerated to say then that Persia was, to some degree at least, a slave state. But that is not to say that there is much truth to Herodotus's claim that the Persian legions fought more poorly than the Greeks because they were just afraid of the whip. Slaves were used in many ways, but rarely as soldiers. The Persian armies were not slave armies. In large part, they depended on mercenaries and on Persian farmers, who became soldiers while slaves tended to their fields, a dynamic that looks a lot like the one enabling the impressive expansion of the Roman Republic. Indeed, if Persia was a slave nation, then their Roman critics were certainly no better, on the contrary. And it's not as if the Greeks were so morally superior either. Their disdain for Persian slavery was pretty hypocritical, if you ask me. The Spartans, for instance, these noble heroes from the 300 movie, were among the most oppressive people to have ever roamed planet Earth. The very reason that they could afford to be full-time warriors was that they kept nearby communities under their thumb, in what amounted to an extreme form of slavery. These so-called helots had to provide the Spartans with all they needed, or else. And even then, their lives were worth less than nothing. They were killed for sport. The Spartans cherished an image of being fearless. The term laconic speech is even named after them. But they did have one recurring nightmare, namely that someone would come and free their unhappy slaves from the grip of their masters. So to portray Leonidas and friends as the great champions of freedom is a bit rich. In Athens and the other city-states, things were hardly better. True, they were very proud of their own freedom, but their philosophers found all sorts of rational excuses why enslaving other people was not only necessary, but beneficial to all. Better to be ruled by a rational person than to be free and irrational. That was the thinking. Theories that would be recycled in modern times, by the way, to legitimize all sorts of oppression and violence. And finally, Persia was overtaken by Alexander the Great, wasn't it? The would-be philosopher king, pupil of Aristotle. Wouldn't you expect the despotism to soften a bit under Greek tutelage then? Well, that didn't happen. On the contrary, the Hellenistic kings were presented as living gods. How much more tyrannical can you get, really? So yes, the Persians were a slave society, but so was nearly everyone else at the time. It wasn't a significant factor in determining the outcome of the confrontation with the Greeks or anything. Now, some of you might say, isn't that missing the point a bit? The Athenians had just invented the democracy. So had Darius and Xerxes ran over them, this experiment would have been snuffed out before it could reach maturity. Well, first of all, that's by no means certain. One of the great innovations of Persia was that its subject peoples were allowed to hang on to their traditions, including their forms of government, as long as they stayed loyal to Persia. They assumed it would make them more content and thus less likely to revolt. As long as they paid their taxes and such, they could more or less do as they pleased. True, it's likely that the naughty Athenians would be banished to some wasteland in Central Asia, but those city-states that came over to the Persian side, they could have kept their system of government. Ionian city-states, for instance, were allowed to retain their democracy, or what passed for that at the time, under Persian overlordship. It reminds me a bit even of the European Union, which lets its member states keep their own systems, even if they become less than democratic, apparently. So what other insults did the Persians get hurled at them? That they were corrupt. Now, first of all, judged by modern standards, every ancient society was as corrupt as all get out. But it would be unfair and even absurd to measure them against that yardstick. Gift-giving and nepotism were part of what made the empire stick together and function. It was not a bug, it was a feature. But not every form of corruption would be seen as appropriate, of course. And the Persians were often accused of bribing their opponents, too. But they had money to burn. Wouldn't it be strange, then, to expect them not to use it for political gain? There is no doubt that they did this, and often. For instance, some of those who led the heroic stand against Xerxes later ended up in his court, like the Athenian leader Themistocles, most famously. But there are two ways of looking at this. The lazy viewpoint, perhaps, is to say that he was corrupted by Persian money. But in reality, he was chased out of Athens and came looking for fortune himself. Who then is the most corrupt? The man who gives a bribe in the service of his country, or he who accepts it, or asks for it even, to the detriment of his? Now, it must be said that the Persians were very creative in using their wealth. They subsidized a Spartan fleet, for instance, so that it might attack Athens. And why stop at bribing enemy leaders when you could just as well bribe their gods? They found it easy, apparently, to get the Oracle of Delphi on their side. When the great king was on his way to attack Greece, through the mouth of his priestess, the god Apollo told the Greeks to leave their belongings and run for their lives. When he made it to Delphi eventually, the Persian commander thanked the god by burning an extravagant amount of incense. Again, this says something about the resourcefulness of the Persians, but it says just as much, I think, about the Greeks that even their priests would be happy to accept such a bribe, even as it led to the destruction of their lands. Another cliché about the Persians is that they were decadent, and above all, their king Xerxes. He is depicted as a spoiled dandy, sitting on a comfortable throne so that he can watch the battles from afar while being fed haute cuisine. This contrasts sharply with the simplicity of his enemies. Above all, Leonidas, who bravely leads his handful of men in combat against terrible odds. The underlying message is that if Xerxes is ultimately defeated, that's because of his decadence, and perhaps by extension, that of his people. They've grown too soft. Now, this view of history is truly ages old. We already talked about Ibn Khaldun's theory of Asabidja and of Voltaire's great line that you can always hear the sound of wooden shoes going up the stairs and silk slippers going down. In fact, this idea was already exploited by the father of history, Herodotus. According to him, Cyrus the Great, the founder of the Persian dynasty, warned his people that if they chose to move into the rich cities and comfortable houses of their enemies, they should prepare to be rulers no more. We have, of course, no way of knowing whether this really happened, presumably not. As a rule, practically all actual speeches by people in the ancient world are made up by later historians, but it's not crazy to think that Cyrus might indeed have said something of the kind. And if he had, it's clear that his elite ignored his advice. The common people of Persia, however, never became rich, though both Persian and Greek propaganda would propagate that image. Professor Jones, building on the local sources, including the discovery of clothes from 500 BCE in 2008, explains how the royal dress would have changed in just a few generations. He describes how the young King Cyrus the Great would have looked. He would wear a tunic of wool and the gaunaka, which I can only describe as some sort of long-sleeved cloak. Both were meant to protect the body, including the hands, against wind and frost. He would also have worn long woolen pants. The Persians probably invented trousers. It's one of their gifts to the world, you might say. But for them, it was not just a fashion item. Trousers had to protect the legs from the irritation that would otherwise come from riding a horse all day without a saddle. And finally, he would also wear high thick boots, so not exactly silk slippers. The only thing about his look that the Greeks might have mistaken for a sign of effeminacy was the mascara around his eyes, but that was just a random cultural thing. For comparison, the Spartans would grow their hair long and comb it elaborately. But if that made you think that they were hippies, you would be in for a nasty surprise. In short, the early Persian king would not look glamorous by any stretch. And if he had, that would not have sat well with his men. He had to look like someone they felt connected to. Now contrast that with his grandson Xerxes. Joan describes him as an over-the-top mannequin. Every lock of his hair would have been a masterpiece, curled and perfumed to perfection. His robes would be in purple or saffron. He would still have the trousers, but these would also be rather chic, made of silk like his shoes. And then, to top it all off, you have to imagine an absurd amount of jewelry, earrings, bracelets, the whole lot. So I guess the analogy of the silk slippers does seem to apply, and quite literally at that. But that may still be a superficial way of looking at things. What of his activities? Were they the pastime of a spoiled kid? Well, the Persian elite retained some aspects of their original nomadic lifestyle, but it's a bit like with the trousers. They're still pants, but in every other aspect, quite another thing. The king remained a nomad in the sense that he traveled all the time, like the shepherds that he is descended from, that would take their flock into the mountains during summer, and then into the valley when it got colder. And so too, the king traveled from his winter palace in Babylon to his summer hideout in the highlands of Ecbatana. And there were other capitals, the most symbolically important being in Persepolis, where the king would sit in his stunning great hall and accept tribute from his satrapies. The reason for these travels were not just nostalgic. His occasional presence kept different corners of the empire in line. The king was effectively the beating heart of the state, and that meant he had to govern while he was traveling. Now, as would later be said of the Mongols, you can conquer from the saddle, but you can't rule from the saddle. But the Persians came close. Though Xerxes still wore pants, reminder of his heritage, he would probably not often ride himself. Instead, he would be carried hither and thither, so that he could work while on campaign. The CEO of a big company doesn't drive his own car. He's brought places in his limo or in the company jet. But according to Jones, his feet could never touch the ground. There always had to be at least a carpet under his feet. This was symbolic. Other people were supposed to get down on the ground before him. Such protocol was considered very important. The Greeks would of course see this as yet another sign of tyranny. They felt that kneeling was only appropriate before the gods. We've talked about that in the episode on Alexander and what consequences that would have had. Whenever he was traveling, he still slept in a tent. But again, this was not so much camping, but rather glamping. His tent was a mobile palace, extremely ornate, with spectacular draperies, priceless furniture, lots of soft pillows. The king was always accompanied by a huge retinue. They made sure that he could eat the finest food, drink the most exquisite wine. Every region in his empire, every satrapy, had to send their very best products to him as tokens of submission. And he had more pretty girls at his disposal than that he could copulate with. More on that later. The system redistributed wealth towards the king's inner circle, and the state kept close track of who got what. And this has shown that other royals, like the Queen Mother for instance, enjoyed a life of extreme opulence too. So on the surface, yes, the Persian elite at least had gone from rags to riches in just a few generations. But I don't think it would be right to imagine their existence as easy. Would you want to be king of Belgium, say? Well, I wouldn't. Everything you do is watched by countless eyes. Everything is ritualized and judged. With the King of Kings of Persia, that was also the case, times 100. Unlike the King of Belgium, bless his heart, he couldn't just limit himself to attending a few receptions every few weeks. Xerxes had to prove himself from a very young age. He had to measure up to the standards of his formidable father Darius. He boasted of his skills as a warrior, as did later kings of kings. Princes were entrusted with important responsibilities from very early on. This fact may even partly be responsible for the Achaemenid's relative success. The golden kids were not locked away, like so many Safavid princes later, and perhaps as a consequence, doesn't seem like there were many incompetent kings in all this time. If you didn't understand how the game of politics was played, you wouldn't be around for long, even if you were a first-born prince. Even the harem, generally regarded as a symbol of decadence, was not all about sexual entertainment. True, the King of Kings was supposed to have lots of sex, but not just and not mainly because he enjoyed it. He had to produce offspring. But the harem served more purposes besides breeding. It was the most important government institution of all. In an autocracy, whoever gets to live in the king's house is certain to wield a lot of influence. Since the princes were sent away on important assignments from an early age, these influential people were rarely men. And that brings me to another slur that the Greeks would throw at the Persians, that they were so weak of character that they were even ruled by women. Greeks considered that a very bad thing. In a place like Athens, women were about as empowered as those in today's Afghanistan. So no doubt, Greek commentators would surely have delighted in gossiping how their archenemies were bossed about by women and eunuchs. So many have argued that all the accounts about the excesses of court life tell us more about Greek fantasies than about what really went on there. But not so fast. We must be careful not to dismiss what is likely just because it sounds cinematic. There's plenty of evidence that the dominant women around the king had huge power and massive wealth. That should not be surprising. So much power is invested in one person, and family connections play such an outsized role. Then those with close access to the king, those that managed to get on his good side, would always amass great power. To give you an idea, in one of the texts found in Persepolis, it casually mentions that the queen received 11,368 liters of wine. She must have been thirsty. Important court women had their own giant estates, taken care of by bureaucrats. Queen mothers often traveled with their sons, as did the other court women, but they could also travel alone, or rather with their own large retinue, holding court in similar fashion as the king, but on a slightly smaller scale. In general, the evidence shows that common women in the Persian Empire also generally enjoyed much more freedom than in a place like Athens. What of the eunuchs? In Greek society, which was obsessed with physical perfection, especially of males, their deformation would be looked upon with disdain. So those who cater to a Greek anti-Persian audience would certainly have an incentive to imagine lots of sneaky castrates in the Persian court. However, there's no question that eunuchs really were numerous in the halls of power. Babylon alone was requested to send no less than 500 castrated boys to the king each single year. Imagine being the person responsible for carrying out such a command. And then to imagine that castration was by no means a safe procedure. It would be hard to pull that off safely even today, to say nothing of an age with hardly any medical knowledge to speak of. In fact, Greek doctors were considered the crème de la crème at the time. One of them is a main source of information on Persia, or should that be gossip? And to give you an idea of their level of expertise, a Greek doctor reportedly gave a royal woman who suffered from a tumor the prescription that she should have lots of sex with him. But I'm digressing. The eunuchs did often wield a lot of influence. Like with the royal women, this was simply a result of the way that the kingdom revolved around the king and his harem. The eunuchs were regarded as a third sex, which gave them access where real men, in air quotes, were turned away. For that same reason, eunuchs were prevalent in many courts around the world until relatively recently. Usually places that also had harems, like China, India, or the Ottoman Empire. Rest assured that all this is not an invention of a writer who wants to show just how pathetic all these people were. Just like you don't need to be an Orientalist to believe that the Persian courts were riven with palace intrigue, I think. This is the case with nearly every autocracy in history. Until today, just look at the trials and tribulations of the inner circle around Assad or Kim Jong-un. But as with the women, and indeed with all the signs of so-called decadence, this begs the question, what was the net result of all this? Were these eunuchs and women wicked spreaders of corruption like the Greeks would have us believe? Well, unsurprisingly to me, there are no signs of that. For one thing, the belief that eunuchs were by definition weaklings proved to be wrong. Some, like Bagoas, whom we talked about in the last episodes, attained their high positions precisely because they had balls. Some commanded armies in person, and many royal women were formidable politicians as well. Their environment was every bit as dangerous as that of the kings and princes. In the harem, the slightest misstep could prove as fatal as on the battlefield. It was a place of strict decorum. The queen mother was supposed to be at the top of the food chain. She was the one who had brought the king into the world, after all, and she was the only one whose interests aligned completely with his. Although, as we will yet see, there were even exceptions to that rule. Just below the queen mother, you had the king's favorite queen, his wives and sisters, foreign concubines, and finally, the slave girls. That seems clear enough, but as always, informal connections could undermine and change the formal hierarchy. One of the king's partners could become the king's favorite, and that way she could overpower her rivals. He was just a man, after all. Kings too can fall in love. And these women often did all they could to make that happen. It was the obvious way to climbing the ladder in the harem. If they succeeded, they and their families stood to profit mightily, but they would inevitably make enemies along the way, and if these got on top, be very afraid. It's a strange thing to say, but perhaps we should spare a thought also for the King of Kings. To live in such a giant and complex household, riven with rivalries, that must have been exhausting, and unless they were made of stone, emotionally challenging. It's no wonder that love triangles often don't work out. Keeping more than one partner happy is a delicate balancing act, although I must say I don't speak from experience. And we have to keep in mind that these women weren't there on their own volition. Now, I may be projecting my own 21st century feelings on these people, but that must have been frustrating for these kings, I think. At least with your wife, you would want to let down your guard for once, no? That must be a universal human need, I think. But that's hard if you can suspect that she has a hidden agenda. Even for present-day celebrities, it can be hard to filter the good ones out of a multitude of gold diggers, right? But it's not as if these Persian kings met their future wives in a club or a dating site. They were often brought to him by force. They were either used by their families as a ticket to fortune, or more often hand-picked by spies from all over the country, often because of their looks and charm. The odds were rather higher, I think, that the king would fall for at least one of these countless beauty queens than that they would love him back. Now, the women could fall in love with him, theoretically. Power eroticizes, I've been told. Still, it would be an unlikely coincidence. Besides, they could hardly afford romantic feelings. They were caught up in a zero-sum game with their many rivals. It was a bit like The Bachelor, but in this case, if you didn't win, you could very well die. And even if you did do well, poison making was seen as a fine art in the Persian court, and no one was safe from that. Now, the dynastic rivalry and the ambitions of other noble clans may partly explain the Achaemenids' tendency to marry their close relatives. There existed no right of the firstborn in Persia. Who became the heir depended on the choice of his father, and once the king was dead, on the support of important clan leaders. Marrying their daughters was the key to getting their support. They would want nothing more than to align themselves to the royal family. It brought them close to the center of power, and their grandchild might even become king someday. But once, perhaps with their support, that a new king had captured his throne, these marriage connections became a risk. As thanks for their loyalty, they would crave more marriage ties with the royal family, and once they amassed enough legitimacy that way, they might feel ready for a coup. If the king wanted to avoid that, it made sense for him to marry the women in his inner circle himself, not to have actual relations with them necessarily, although that would happen, but more importantly, to make sure that they were off the wedding market. If a king married his own sisters, for example, he would render them permanently unavailable to the other ambitious men out there. That said, this would not have happened if there had existed a taboo against incest, and that was expressly not the case. On the contrary, both their religion and ancient local customs endorsed it. More on that in a later episode. Now, I'd like to give you a colorful illustration of how all these things may have worked out in practice. It is the story of Parysatis, perhaps the most infamous grande dame of the entire Achaemenid era. But be warned, since this is based on Greek sources, often close to Parysatis, you should take it with a pinch of salt, I think. But then again, if Professor Jones has no qualms about telling this tale, why should I? Parysatis was the daughter of a former king and a foreign concubine. Her half-brother would become king of kings under the name Darius II, and that in itself was striking, as he also was just the son of a concubine. Parysatis would supposedly have had a hand in his rise to the top, which would have been remarkable already, but her power would only grow from there. Once her half-brother became king, she married him. That was a win-win. He did not have to fear that she might wed some ambitious chieftain, and she would enjoy a key position at court. In fact, Darius is supposed to have depended heavily on her advice. A sign of just how strong her position was is that her eldest son became crown prince, while her younger son, Cyrus, was made satrap of Lydia and nearby places, probably again at her instigation. Cyrus was her favorite, so much is clear, but she wasn't even content with that arrangement. She went so far as to openly propose that Cyrus be the heir, not her elder son. And that may have had something to do with the wife of her eldest, Statera. She was the daughter of a Persian nobleman, and she and Parysatis did not get along, to put it mildly. Statera's family would be linked to a rebellion and wiped out. Only Statera would be spared, at the instigation of her husband, and that shows, I think, that Parysatis' elder son was truly in love with his wife, which meant she might eventually wield more influence than Parysatis if he became king. Besides, she might have blamed her mother-in-law for the death of her relatives, who seems to have had a hand in their execution. Not a good way to start off with your daughter-in-law. So Parysatis understood that it would be dangerous for her if her eldest became king with his adored wife at his side. She found Cyrus much easier to control. He was a real mama's boy, if you believe the sources. Perhaps that's why she went so far as to beg her husband's brother to change his mind about the succession, even on his deathbed. But her pleas fell on deaf ears. This would not have escaped the crown prince. It shouldn't be surprising, then, that as soon as he became King Artaxerxes II, his brother would be implicated in a plot, falsely or otherwise. Given Achaemenid history, you could then confidently predict his execution. But surprisingly, Artaxerxes showed mercy, even allowed his brother to return to his giant satrapy. Again, it is rumored, at the instigation of their mother. Cyrus was not grateful, however, and perhaps understandably so. It's not inconceivable that he had been falsely accused and that Artaxerxes just wanted to show who was boss by having him arrested. But if that was the intention, it backfired spectacularly. Cyrus would soon start plotting a coup. In the meantime, the hatred between the king's wife and mother became more and more open. At first, Statera had still deferred to Parysatis, for instance, by sending her the most beautiful gift that she received herself, saying it was only fit for the king's mother. But as she gained more influence, she became more assertive. She would play up her noble Persian ancestry, while everyone knew, of course, that Parysatis was only the daughter of a foreign concubine. Statera proved to be an unusual character. She would ride in an open carriage, showing herself to the common people, and even stopping for the occasional chat. That was a very atypical display of PR, that Parysatis took as an affront to the entire dynasty. In the ancient world, to be precious was to be hidden. That's why the King of Kings dined behind a curtain, why his women lived in a harem. For fans of Game of Thrones, doesn't this scene remind you of another rivalry between a queen mother and a queen? Now, if Statera was indeed trying to become a Lady Di of sorts, she was way ahead of her time. But stranger things have happened, and the Persian elite were very much occupied with their public image, so who knows? Cyrus eventually put together an army from the western satrapies, some of whom supported his claim to the throne, and of mercenaries, mostly Greeks. Among them was an Athenian aristocrat named Xenophon, whose memoirs would become famous and a unique source of information for us. Strikingly, we also have Greek witnesses on the other side of the upcoming struggle. Among them, the king's personal doctor. Cyrus marched his army east, but much like Putin recently, he didn't reveal to his men what he was up to until the last minute. In the following battle at Sunaxa, he would be killed, however. But it would be a close-run thing. Artaxerxes himself would be wounded and cared for by the man who happens to be our main source. By the way, the fact that he got badly hurt is perhaps a sign that these kings of kings were no shrinking violets. Artaxerxes then ordered his confidant to find his brother's corpse and to cut off his head and hands. He could then show these to the people so that Cyrus's supporters would know that their case was lost. After some confused negotiations, the remainder of the Greek mercenaries, now decimated and leaderless, slowly made their way home, including Xenophon. That they managed to do this eventually has been regarded as a sign of decay in Persia. But given the recent civil war, it was only logical, I think, that there was disorder and that Artaxerxes would want these mercenaries gone as quickly as possible. Besides, not all the Greeks would make it home safely. Many would be captured or killed. Artaxerxes also made sure to capture all of Cyrus's women. You never knew whether any of them carried a child that would become a potential usurper somewhere down the road. Cyrus's favorite turned out not to be pregnant, and she would enter the harem of the king. Finally, now that the story was over, Artaxerxes wanted to make sure that it would be told in the best possible way. In reality, Cyrus was probably killed by accident by some unknown assailants. The king would spread a better story. He had done it himself, in a heroic duel at that. He gave huge sums of hush money to all the people involved in the killing of his brother, the fetching of his body and all that. One of them, though, was so bold, or stupid, to shout that the king was a liar. Predictably, he himself was swiftly convicted of lying and silenced forever. the omerta mostly worked, and I take that as a confirmation of my suspicions regarding the Superman exploits of Alexander the Great that are so often accepted at face value. The reason that in this case we know the non-official story at all, it seems, is that Parysatis held a grudge against the people involved in the killing of her favorite boy, and she would see to it that they would be properly punished. The man who had called out that the king was a liar, of course, was an easy target. Parysatis had no trouble convincing Artaxerxes to hand this liar over to her, so that she might give him an appropriate punishment. Read, a horrendous one. That was easy, but if she wanted to get to the others, she had to be more creative. She found it suspicious, apparently, that someone got a huge reward simply because he would have played some minor role in the war. So she asked one of her accomplices to get the guy drunk and then tease him that he had been so lucky to have been so generously rewarded for this triviality. His pride hurt. He couldn't hold back his tongue and said something to the effect of, "Generous my ass, I killed Cyrus, so he'd better be grateful." So then Parysatis can go tell Artaxerxes that this guy boasted about killing his brother, making him look bad, of course. And as planned, the king reacts furiously and agrees that Parysatis punished this man. This time, she would be even more vicious. She ordered that the man be put in a lake between two boats that would be stacked on top of each other, with his head and limbs sticking out. Then he was force-fed a mixture of milk and honey, which was also smeared all over his face. The idea was to attract vermin, but also to give him terrible diarrhea. He inevitably soiled himself after a while, and then he would slowly be eaten, both from the outside and the inside, by bugs and rats and maggots. It could take forever, apparently. This heartwarming story reminds me of another cliché about the so-called despotic East, its proverbial cruelty. Greek writers delighted in telling tales about their inhuman torture methods. Horror, it seems, has always captured the human fascination, even thousands of years before Saw or Scream. But there is no denying that the Persians were often extremely thorough in their punishments, especially if there was treason involved. Now, there is no doubt that Parysatis was cruel, but we have to remember that practices like impaling and disfiguring were all too common in the region and had been for a long time. Besides, it's not as if Europe never saw anything on the same level of horrificness. Crucifixion comes to mind, or burning at the stake, or breaking on the wheel. All not that much more pleasant, I assume. Look, I'm beginning to sense a pattern here. Turns out that there is often much truth to the stories that the Greeks told about Persia. There's just nothing typically Persian about it. So to finish this tale, Parysatis would eventually overstep the line when she went after the eunuch who had been tasked with cutting off Cyrus's head. This guy had just been following the king's orders, and he had been discreet about it too, so Artaxerxes would have no reason whatsoever to be angry with him, on the contrary. So she had to use another trick. According to the source, one time, she played a game of dice with her son. She was very good at it, reportedly, but she lost a lot of money on purpose. Then she asked for a rematch, but with higher stakes. The winner could pick one of the other's slaves. Now you can no doubt see where this is going. She won this time, and she chose the eunuch. The king was perplexed, no doubt, that this was no household slave, but he saw little harm in it. But as soon as the eunuch got to her palace, she had him flayed alive. When Artaxerxes found out, he realized that he had been fooled, and what's worse, that his mother had done this because she was still angry that his treacherous brother had been killed instead of him. This must have broken his heart, right? Still, she acted as if nothing was wrong. "Oh, sore loser," she's supposed to have said. "As a king, shouldn't you think before you act and accept the consequences?" And that wasn't the end of her mischief, even. She pretended to make her peace with her daughter-in-law. She would invite Statera to dinner, something that could hardly be refused. After all, now that all the killers of her son were dead, perhaps Parysatis was ready to make peace. Besides, the two of them would eat from the same food and drink from the same wine. Healthy precaution. But according to the story, and take this for what it's worth, Parisatis found an ingenious way around this problem. They were about to eat from the same little bird, so she ordered one of her servant girls to cut it in half with a knife that had secretly been smeared with poison on one side, so that her half would not be corrupted. Statera died in agony. Artaxerxes was of course furious, even more so as his mother then refused to give up the servant girl who had poisoned his wife. Now the king had really had it. He took the drastic but long overdue step of having his mother removed from his side. She would spend some time in comfortable exile on one of her large estates in Babylon. But eventually he called her back. Perhaps understandably, everyone only has one mother after all. With Statera gone, her influence over the king would become greater than ever, and she lived happily ever after. The end. So what do you think? Would the world of politics be more cooperative and peaceful if it were dominated by women? Hang on, I'm joking, of course. Even if this were all true, Parisatis is not exactly representative of all women, is she? In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if part of this story was made up to take aim at her and her sex. It teaches us nothing whatsoever about women in general. But perhaps it can teach us what kind of person tends to thrive in this kind of environment, regardless of their gender. After all, there were plenty of men in the Achaemenid family that acted just as viciously as Parisatis. Look no further than Artaxerxes III, one of Statera's kids. Once he becomes king, he will murder practically his entire family, just to make sure that no one can threaten him. And eunuchs, the third sex, they could be just as ferocious. Just think of Bagoas, whom we talked about in the last episode. This castrate murdered not one but two kings and attempted to poison a third. You also find many such characters in other empires ruled by one person. The tragedy is that this brutal environment also happens to be one of those rare places where women can more easily overcome the glass ceiling. If power is centered around one hereditary ruler, through their connections to him, women can gain huge power, both formally and informally. You hear plenty of stories of powerful and murderous women in the Roman Empire, for instance, but I don't know any from the Republican era. Alas, it's all too easy to confuse correlation with causality, and this in turn tends to reinforce stereotypes about women and eunuchs, as if the influence of their sex is a reason behind the excesses of autocratic rule. If there is a lesson here, for me, it's that the circumstances make the man or woman. If in a certain system the worst always seem to get on top, perhaps you should think about changing the system. In an older episode, we asked what the world might look like today if there was never a Roman Empire. Now, one of the scenarios in which that would probably have been the case is if the Achaemenids had not been vanquished by Alexander the Great, which was far from inevitable. Alternatively, if Xerxes conquers Greece, then maybe Athenian democracy never reaches maturity, which would make it unlikely that it ever has a global impact. Greece and Rome are to a large degree role models for our systems of government and law. What if it had been Persia instead? There would presumably be more emphasis on the ruler. But in large parts of the world, this is the case, of course. Most dictatorships pay lip service to democracy and other ideals, but in reality, they function more like the Persian court, with patronage, spies, propaganda, all that. Speaking of which, when it comes to how they present themselves, modern empires like the United States, France, or Great Britain may owe more to Persia than to Rome. They proclaimed that their domination is effectively good for everyone. Now that narrative is a Persian invention, as we will yet see. In some small measure at least, this was an improvement because it implies that at least to some degree, the Persians cared about how their subjects felt about them. Unlike the Romans, or later European colonizers, the Persians didn't force their own superior culture onto subject peoples. On the contrary, they created a totally new imperial culture that would be a blend of their own traditions and those of others. This amounted to almost anything: writing, clothing, architecture, you name it. For instance, instead of forcing their own language on others, they adopted the script of the Medes. Other parts of the empire could keep their own languages. As far as there was a common language, it would be Aramaic, which was widely spoken anyway. Such pragmatism could have saved a great deal of misery elsewhere. It reminds me a bit of the European Union. Everyone can keep his own language, and in case you ever need a common tongue, take English. With Britain out of the Union, they can no longer be accused of forcing their language on other member states. You still have the Irish, but, you know, no one feels threatened by them, I suppose. Perhaps because of their humble roots, the Persians were not too inflexible to recognize if others had better ideas. They were great adopters. If they couldn't build good ships or row hard enough, but the Phoenicians could, well, why not enlist them? If they didn't have a writing system, why not adopt another? This, I think, explains their success to a large degree. It's a lesson that almost any nation can use to its benefit. Look around you and adopt what works. A more decentralized form of government also allows you to experiment. Not everyone needs to make the same mistakes. So in some senses, a little more Persian influence might not be all that bad. Their flexibility may even have been key in their military success. Older empires tried to create uniform armies, in which everyone fought basically the same way. But the Persians allowed more diversity in that area too. If a certain people is trained in fighting with spears, why would you make them use bows? If Greeks make such great hoplites, why would you put them on horses? This has the additional advantage that you have, in effect, a key for every door. You need to fight in a desert? Well, it just so happens we have some camel nomads in our army. Why not bring them over and let them do it? And the bigger the empire, the more varied your military arsenal. In theory, this might even put the infamous dynamic of imperial overstretch on its head. Indeed, it doesn't seem like the Persians suffered from that very much. Now, it must be said that just how varied the Persian armies were is still up for debate. Herodotus loves to point out what a colorful spectacle it would have been to see elephants and steppe riders, even Africans with huge bows with stone arrowheads, all present in the same spot. But to impress onlookers may precisely have been the purpose of their presence. So the King of Kings could show friend and foe just how big his empire was and how futile to try and withstand him. These may also have been just small contingents of hostages, not really meant to fight, but rather to keep the home country in line while the army was somewhere else. It may also have been a symbol of the general self-image of Persia. In Persepolis, the artwork shows many distinct peoples, side by side, all in their recognizable garb, bringing gifts to the great king. The Persians didn't want to turn others into copies of themselves. They saw themselves as the leaders of these other peoples. Subject peoples still had their kings. The Persian one was just the King of Kings. And it's likely that the organization of the army mirrored that idea, with local contingents that were led by Persian commanders, while the so-called immortals, the Persian elite forces, would make up the core of the army. We'll talk some more about the strengths of the Persian Empire in the next episode, but if it had one clear weakness, it was the fact that so much power rested in one individual. There were few safeguards if the ruler was blatantly incompetent, and the war between the true brothers that I just told you about illustrates how dangerous power transitions could be. The Romans and Greeks, as well as modern democracies, had more or less elegant ways to solve such issues. They didn't always work, but much more often than in authoritarian societies. As the Iranians may find out when their leader should die eventually, or the Russians, or even the Chinese. If it was just a matter of holding elections, the matter could be solved smoothly. I believe it was Karl Popper that said that the great quality of democracy is that it avoids tyranny. Add to that, succession crisis. Now, the fact that you still have so many countries today that struggle with these same issues, is that a sign that the Persian legacy is just as profound as that of the Romans? I don't think so. If there is one thing that struck me as I read about recent scholarship on Persia, it is that although it does seem to confirm that the Persians did fit many of the stereotypes that the Greeks heaped on them, these are not typically Persian. And if the recurring problems with autocracy are not typically Persian, they can also not be blamed for infecting the world with them. The fact that autocracy leads to succession crisis, to name just one thing, is more like a law of nature, I think. And likewise, perhaps Greece also gets a bit too much credit for inventing democracy. Like tyranny, government by the people comes in many shapes and forms. The Greek system has inspired our own, certainly. But look closely, and you will find more differences than similarities. So just maybe, history in general has less of an impact than is usually assumed. How do you like that for an ending to a history podcast? Talk to you next time.